Hi, it's Joel Pilger, and you're listening to episode 86 of the RevThinking podcast.
They are sitting there on epic talent. And although it's a sweeping generalization, a lot of them love being in their zone of creating. And for many, they need to distribute themselves before they can even sell more or anything like that.
Welcome to RevThinking, the podcast for creative entrepreneurs who know the best way to deal with the future is to create it. This is the conversation between creative leaders and consultants, discussing what it really takes to run a thriving creative business.
Hey, Joel here at RevThink, where we exist to help creative owners thrive in business and life and career. I think you're in for a treat today, as my guest is the Richard Moore, who's based in the UK in London. Richard and I met in Milan last year at Digital Design Days, and we immediately connected. I think we were like kindred spirits. The thing I love about Richard is he works with startups. He works as a consultant. He also works with or as a sales coach. But more than anything, I love his infectious personality. He's somebody who loves what he does, and he loves sharing with others. He loves building community. And he's the type of person that when you sit and talk with him, his infectious enthusiasm can't help but get you excited and get you fired up. He talks a lot about sales and about marketing and storytelling, but all from the perspective of being a business owner, trying to launch a business, run a business, and so forth. And I couldn't help but notice that many of his concepts and principles translate into the creative space. So I thought, hey, Richard, let's sit down and have a chat and compare your world with my world, because I want the listeners of the RevThinking podcast to gain some insights that might come from how is sales and marketing done in other spaces? Is it the same? Is it different? And there's this idea that Richard and I dive into about creatives need to learn how to distribute yourself that I thought was really charming. And that became the title of this episode. So without further elaboration on my part, I'll let the episode and the conversation with Richard speak for itself in this episode. And also a brief shout out to those of you that are a former attendee at one of my cohort dinners around the world, that Richard is going to be our guest on the cohort happy hour, the global happy hour that's happening on May 28th. And I want to say thanks to Richard for joining us in that conversation. It'll be great to have you. Okay, I hope you guys enjoy the conversation between myself and Richard Moore.
So I'm curious because you, am I correct? You just came from having dinner with Tim somewhere in London?
Yeah, we did. I had a meeting in London and Tim was in town as well. So I was like, let's go. And we're kind of birds of a feather, he and I, in his words. We not only had shared the same birthday on the 8th of October, but also he was like, oh, do you know this coffee shop called Notes? I was like, well, it happens to be one of my favorite shops in London. So it was perfect. And you know, I think you and I would be very similar, Joe. It's one of those where you're like, you know what, we really should stop here, and because we could talk all night. It was just, it was a lovely meeting and good to hang out with him.
Well, let's start here. I want to ask you just a simple question. One, how did you get to where you are right now? Because when you and I met, it was in Milan, correct?
Yeah, in October.
In October, yeah. We were there both at the Digital Design Days conference. Mm. And I know you and I, when we initially connected, it was through another super connector that was there. And she said, you guys have to meet because both you know, Richard, you and Joel are people who are passionate about building communities of entrepreneurs. And of course, my focus being on the creative entrepreneurs. Mm. But as you and I sat and compared notes, I thought, ooh, we do have a lot of common things or history and experiences and maybe audience in common. Yeah. So tell folks just what's the top line of who Richard is and what is your focus?
Yeah, in the Venn diagram of Joel and Richard as they work, it's quite an overlap, I think, in many ways. So there's a lot of backstory, but the simple bit is after 10 years corporate, working with different businesses, helping with sales in different guises and marketing and so on, I decided I wanted to pivot out. We just had a baby, and a number of really rubbish things had happened around that time. So I'd lost my grandmother that year, who was very close to me. This was back in 2011, I think it was. And then later that year, my daughter was born without an esophagus. So she had to go into surgery within 24 hours and, you know, a whole year ahead of major problems with that. And then 3 months after she was born, my mother had passed away. So I had a really rough year. And it's stunning how there's the perverse upside of adversity in that you end up with real perspective on things. And the following year, I was like, you know, I had this big kind of implosion, and I needed to redesign what my life looked like. So I started dabbling with some consulting, and I knew that I could back myself to sell things. And this is, you know, the early 2010s. And so I was thinking, you know, what does it look like to work more online as a consultant, as opposed to just the face-to-face work I do? Because I was doing a bit of that before I finished with my as an employee. And it's been not just a journey of building businesses with other people and so on since then. It's been in many ways my kind of rebuilding of me and the therapy and so on, exploring different things and making everything very much by design. And if you look at Milan, what you've got there is an example of a lot of hard work culminating in certain people picking up on it and saying, hey, you know what, you're valid enough to be at this event and to meet these people. And, you know, the journey continues. But I've really enjoyed rebuilding from kind of a tight spot. And whilst I look back on the corporate side when I worked in London as something I wouldn't want to return to, I'm also very fond and appreciative of the experience I had there as well. And I think that's very much molded me, as well as all of the rough stuff as well, that that kind of gave me the impetus to switch out.
So the years that you worked in London on the corporate side, and I appreciate that transition that you've been through, and I think it's interesting to hear about that adversity, bringing perspective. The people that you work with mostly now, what categories do they fall into? Are they startups? Are they creative people? What is your audience generally?
Well, because my sweet spot really is taking talent and great ideas and helping the commercializing of it, and or, you know, maybe it's through marketing or direct sales, for instance, it allows me to work very horizontally. So I've worked with a guy in South Dakota that imports luxury leather Italian handbags, all the way through to someone who does event design for e-gaming tournaments. And a lot of the time, it's similar themes in terms of how to sell and commercialize themselves. But I think, to answer your question very directly, I really, really love working with startups, and indeed some solopreneurs as a bit of fun, because they are people who have all the heart and ambition, and often, as I say, a great amount of talent, but they just need a little bit of a nudge or a guide in the right direction, because some people are missing a sense of, well, what do I do, and how do I warm up an audience, and how do I actually close those first sales, all the way through to 9-figure businesses. So tomorrow I'm visiting one of the leading legal publishing businesses in London, and coaching their sales team on face-to-face 6-figure deals. And so it's a nice kind of range, but the themes are often the same throughout. So I work with a lot of corporate clients, because I like doing the big ticket sales, and I like being able to have an impact there, which is noticeable. But it's also, you know, it's just it's a really nice thing to be able to give back when you find those solopreneurs or smaller businesses that have something to give, but they just need a little bit of a nudge and a bit of a kick in the right direction for maybe a month or two. So they're good fun as well.
So when I think about you being in Milan, where that audience was all creative types, these are designers and animators and branding people and digital strategists and things like this. What do you find is particularly energizing or interesting or curious about the people that are in the creative space that you work with?
I am and always have been a major fan of talent, and it's a huge level of respect I have for winners. People who are talented and people who are winners and people who are both are fascinating, and I love being around them, and it is good to be around them. Fascinating thing about people in that space was that I knew I could bring value because they are sitting there on epic talent. And although it's a sweeping generalization, a lot of them love being in their zone of creating, and for many they need to be in, they need to distribute themselves before they can even sell more or anything like that. And whilst life isn't just about selling for these businesses, it's also about building a brand and things like that. It's fascinating that you've got so much talent and ability, and for a lot of them, it's there's no voice on, for instance, online, and as a result, people aren't thinking of them, or they're not showing up in conversations. And as a result of that event, for instance, I picked up some clients, one of whom is fantastic digital design agency, but their big problem was exactly that. They're like, no one knows about us, and we need people talking about us when they're having conversations about X. And so it was really lovely to be able to take such a wonderful talent and just go, if we just do this, this, and this, look at how we can really grow. And getting some really great results for them was just a nice thing. So it was good to be able to see such great talent, but also I didn't feel in any way any kind of imposter syndrome, if you see what I mean, because I wasn't there pretending to be a digital design superstar. I was there saying, you know what, I can help because I'm bringing in the distribution through LinkedIn angle. That was my thing for that particular event.
Well, I love the way you said that creatives need help learning how to distribute themselves. And yes. I'll put it this way. So you tell me, agree or disagree?
Okay, binary.
Okay. Yeah, this is binary, right? Because nice. This is a very common saying that creatives will tell them. And I find many creative entrepreneurs say this. So imagine an owner of a studio or a production company saying something like this. But Richard, it's all about the work. If we just produce great work, everything else will take care of itself.
You're triggering me, Joel. This is taking me to one of the most overused sayings that needs to be destroyed and squashed, which is, and it really shouldn't be used, which is, build it and they will come. It's so terrible when people say that, and it's dangerous, because what it says is, if you make something, even if you make something wonderful, sit back or even keep polishing it, and it will come to you, man. The universe will come to you. And I don't believe we're that lucky. What I believe, because I've seen it, is that we can make wonderful things, and talented people out there can all make wonderful things, but it is a tragedy that people sit on that thing, and or they keep focusing on building that wonderful thing, but they don't distribute it and tell people. And what you end up with is huge talent that is world changing, that doesn't see the light of day because it's not being shared. So that saying needs to be revised from build it and they will come to build it and massively distribute it, talk about it, share it, and iterate it in front of lots of people. And eventually some people may choose to self-select and buy, if you like, but it's not perhaps quite as catchy.
Well, right. It's not as catchy, but you make a really good point. Yeah, no, I agree. First of all, I'm obviously a kindred spirit with you in taking that common myth or that fantasy and destroying it, because I think a lot of creative entrepreneurs suffer with less impact in the world. Like their talent and their gift could have such a greater reach and greater impact and create more value for the world. Yes. But it sits under a bushel, or it's hidden because.
And let's be clear. Let's be clear. We're not talking about it mapping to a transactional outcome. this is the case, that it may help people live a better life or see the world through a more beautiful lens. For example, some of the people that we met in Milan have do some beautiful, wonderful things, and it's like, you know, you've got to get this thing out there. And I, in fact, used an example of someone I know from Italy called Alina, who does oil paintings, and she shares them on LinkedIn. She sells out every day, but also she will get tens of thousands of people a day checking out her post just because they love the art. And I think, you know, there's that periphery as well of wonderful outcomes that go beyond making cash out of this as well. You know, you're doing good to the world when you bring it art.
Well, I know a lot of what you talk about is sales. And I'll just say this, I'm very comfortable with that because I work with a lot of my clients in helping them grow their sales and, of course, marketing and positioning and related things. Mm. But what I'm curious to get your perspective on is when it comes to working with creatives, why is sales often a dirty or sleazy word?
Yeah, I'm really glad you've added that little thing of why when it comes to creatives, because if we're being blunt about it, and that therefore means that there are exceptions that I'm overlooking, creatives tend to have a lot of soul about them, and they love, you know, something that's well turned out and well polished, and that makes people feel good, and they want to avoid things that make people feel awkward, and I think we all do, but they don't want that to be associated with their great art. But the truth is, sales as an umbrella term holds underneath it a whole spectrum, and at one end you have the Wolf of Wall Street style, call them irritants or pests, that are smashing a phone and screaming a script and maybe not getting the outcome emotionally that the person at the end of the phone is after, all the way through to more of a consultative side, or in fact, indeed, even further still to more of a, let me just share enough value and you decide if you like it. And the problem is that sales has the stigma attached to it because typically it relates to a transaction, and when money gets involved, people act weird and they try and cut corners, and because they might make money, they play the volume game and irritate people. And what's sad is that a good bit of marketing or sharing or distribution can lead people to want to buy. And the thing is that although people don't like to be sold to, people love to buy. And when an artist learns that there's a really wonderful way of bringing people to them who decide through being pre-warmed that they want to buy that art, it's a wonderful thing. It's just, you know, that education is required. You know, it needs to be done in the right way.
All right. So I'm very curious to unpack one or two things that you said there, because I'm sort of grinning from ear to ear, because I think there's so many interesting points that you're making. One that I really like that you just said that I want to hang on for a quick second is you used the word consultative.
Yes.
And this is something I'm wondering if we might free creatives, release them from having this sleazy interpretation of the word sales. Mm. If we said sales is simply your opportunity to build a relationship with somebody and share your expertise in order to help improve their life, their business, their world, right? And obviously, here's my question for you. My question is, when you're selling something small, say a $10 widget,
right?
It's all about scale. It's all about building a funnel and creating a mass audience and so forth.
Yeah.
But if I'm trying to sell a $100,000 piece of content, like a documentary film or a television commercial that's going to impact millions of viewers.
Yeah.
I find that sales process, it has to be consultative, to use your word. Mm-hmm. Would you agree or not in your experience?
I think it depends, because some people will buy something for £100,000 price point within a day because it's just hitting all the buttons, and then other people take more time. yeah, it makes sense to be consultative, but I was actually asked this question on a QA and Q&A earlier today, and the actual question was, what's different when selling higher ticket items like 100K? And I said, what I feel is that whilst every single deal from a dollar to $100,000 requires trust, because without trust, there's no transaction. No one will risk even that dollar. The trust and the connection has to run deeper with the higher value product. So I think what it needs to look like isn't necessarily just consulting your way through the process to the transaction. It's building sufficient amount of deeper trust with that person through a relationship that makes them feel comfortable that you've got this and you're going to look after them and their money's in safe hands. And if I look to six-figure deals that I've done, they've always, the difference in the pitch is almost nothing, but the difference in the amount of interfacing with the buyer has been huge. And, you know, it's just a greater amount of depth. It's perhaps more dinners or more margaritas or whatever it might be. But the point is that there's a greater connection. And what I'm, if you can visualize it as the bigger the deal, the more you're standing shoulder to shoulder with them, as opposed to nose with them. And there's a massive difference there, I think, in vibe, where you're helping them buy as opposed to selling to them. It's a huge difference.
Yeah, I'm thinking of a moment I had last week where I was working with a client, and let's say one of the partners, she's an executive producer, and she was saying, no, I don't do sales. And I said, what if I just gave you permission to use a different word, would you be okay with it? Because what I find is you work with these clients of your production company, and they love you because you solve their problems and you build strong relationships with them. You know who their kids are. You know that their kids just won the soccer tournament. And this is genuine. This is not some sort of artificial process, that you really care about these people. And when you care about them on that level, the trust that it generates leads to more projects, more opportunities. Wouldn't you agree? And she said, yes. And that's what I love about my job. I said, okay, then let's just not call it sales, but can you please just keep doing that, because it works.
Absolutely. And that's the point, is like, that is sales. That's just more of an evolved, elegant, fulfilling way of doing it. And she is totally selling. And the thing is, by having that relationship, it gets validated in the commercial space by a transaction of money in typically, and everyone is gleefully getting on with the process of giving the money or receiving giving the service, and no one has a problem with it when it feels good. No one has a problem with the selling side, and no one has a problem with giving the cash when it feels good. And, you know, I've heard the same thing a lot, when it's like, you know, oh, I hate salespeople, I hate selling. It's like, what you mean is you hate a particular type of selling. And I went through in the late 2000s a minor crisis of like, why have I got this sales thing? Why am I doing sales? And I didn't feel there's nobility in it. And I felt, you know, I was being comparative with friends who perhaps were moving up the chain, and they were in the traditional professions. They're in law or accounting or whatever. I remember my friends saying, you know, you don't want to do the kind of sales you're currently doing, because you're current. And he said, I know what you actually do, and what you're doing is you're covering it up and kind of describing it in a different way. And he said, you shouldn't be leaving sales. You should be leaving this type of sales and moving to something that's more akin to what you're interested in doing. And he was right. It was like, I still loved the process of selling, but actually wanted to do it in more of for want of a better phrase, a grown up way.
Well, it's interesting to say, did I hear you right, that you said if you don't like doing sales, it's because you're doing the wrong type of sales.
Yeah, I think that everyone actually loves selling when it's done in a more fulfilling way. It's a wonderful thing when someone comes to you pre-warmed and says, you know, I'm pre-qualified and says, I'd love to talk to you about how, I mean, literally I had two of these today where someone was like, I'd love to talk to you about how you can help. You know, what person wouldn't want to do that? And at the end, they're like, oh my God, I knew this was a great idea. How would it look? And then you're like, okay, and then like this. And, you know, who wouldn't enjoy that? And that's not irritating or difficult or, you know, and it's because we're not approaching people who don't want to be sold to in a way that doesn't help sell them in the first place.
Well, I'm thinking back to the days when I was running my own creative studio. And I always thought, is there anything more fun than I get to work with these amazing clients that work at these TV networks and these entertainment companies. And I sit around with my team and we come up with some really cool ideas. And then I call my client and I say, I've got this thing that you should think about. I think this would be so fun. And long and short of it, a week or two later, we're shaking hands over the phone and saying, let's do it. And sometimes these were multi $100,000 projects.
Yeah.
And it wasn't complicated. I mean, again, some of these deals do get quite complicated and there's contracts and legal and so forth. But
yeah,
sometimes these types of opportunities really are built on trust and there's a handshake. And you later look back and realize, wow, we just did millions of dollars of work with this company this year and we never signed any agreements. There were no contracts. So what's going on here? And I think it speaks to that word trust that you used earlier.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a depth of, you know, you by extension are part of my team. And what it comes down to is that it's just funny because people are like, oh man, it's the awkward moment of money. And in those moments, it doesn't even cross their mind about spending the money because Well, that's the oil that drives the device. You need to put the money in to pay the people who are going to do this great thing. And the whole transaction is outrageously superseded by the sense or perception of value that they're getting. And it's like the magic I'm receiving, the upside, the wins for us are awesome. Hell yes, have the money because I can just see how I'm getting so much from this. And that's what a good deal looks like. It's not a begrudging, do you know what, I'll take a punt on it and I can afford to lose, another word being kind of gamble, this much money. And that's a reflection of poor trust and not a sense of value. And that's where you get terrible things happening, like let's try and discount our way over the line and things like that, when in fact you should be working more on building relationship. And, you know, the science shows 2/3 of a reason why people buy something is really down to that connection. People don't buy iPhones because they need that particular type of phone. It costs $1,000. They buy it because they're bought into being part of a tribe and having that connection with Apple and so on. And, you know, and that's the bit that really matters. And it's the trust in the brand and so on. And the whole perception is there, as opposed to it technically being pound for pound a better phone than the next one on the shelf, you know?
Well, I don't remember where I heard this, but I loved this expression. I heard someone say, you know, people who don't talk about money don't make it. And it's this idea that when you're talking with a client, if you're avoiding talking about money, it's because you have some sort of shame or you're embarrassed. You don't think you're really worth it. But sometimes the best deal is when somebody says, okay, we're obviously talking about a big idea here. So let's just confirm that we're talking about spending $100,000 or more. And your client says, yes. And you go, great. Okay. Let's continue this conversation. This is really exciting. I'm not embarrassed about the money. I'm excited because now I know I can go create an amazing result. What would you say to that? How would you navigate that?
I think it's spot on. And what it represents is the bashfulness or concern over asking represents a fear based on the salesperson's doubts about what they have to offer. And what's interesting about the psychology behind things like deal confidence is, if you imagine that every meeting you ever had converted to a huge deal, think about how you'd react when you were in front of someone. You'd just have that, you'd have that kind of cocksure approach, and you'd be really certain that there's just absolutely no problem at all to asking. And the thing is this, is that those that are fearful are preserving a state in that meeting or phone call or whatever of things are kind of all right now, and I don't want to rock the boat, and this is preferable to rejection or the unknown that may come from asking for a deal or suggesting we talk about money. But there is something that supersedes feeling nice about a nice conversation, which is the truth. And the truth is what you should be chasing, which is, where are we right now? Is this going to happen? And one thing I've learned for certain is, around decision makers, a little bit of candor goes a long way to building respect and to getting a real vibe about if you're going to work together with someone. And it helps build that sense of trust and really nails the point. You're not there to game anyone. And you're like, hey, let's just be real right now. Are we talking about this? And there's that euphoric moment where they're like, yeah, absolutely, like you've just said. And you're like, okay, great, let's do this then. And I think the main thing is that people remember that if they are sold on the product or service and the value therein when they go into a meeting, then they should have no problem with the price. And if they are getting concerned about talking about money, they shouldn't be in a meeting trying to sell their product right then. They need to go back, speak to their manager or speak to their team or speak to whatever evangelist is necessary to say, hey, why are we worth this again? And really get sold on what they're capable of doing. Because when you get it, you can't help but you know, say to the person at the other side of the table, like, with conviction, you know, this is really worth it. And it is effortless then to talk about money, because you see why.
Yeah, you use the word candor. And I'm wondering, is that maybe a synonym for vulnerability?
Yeah, I think it can be. And I think it is. It also, a lot of people think candor means being curt, direct, even bordering rude with someone. But it doesn't need to mean that. It means openness and being and you know, showing you on that wavelength with them. So I think it can do. I really do. And it just kind of clears to one side any kind of gaming that anyone might fear might be happening. It's just like, look, let's get real right now. And the truth is, people don't speak like that unless they are wanting to be open with someone, because it's all shadiness otherwise. And you know, people need to learn that that's something to be avoided. You can't try and game someone into buying your deal. You need to be open and really transparent with them. And that has to come across in the kind of vibe you give across and indeed in your language too.
So I know one thing, after looking at some of your materials and some of your things online, and by the way, your social media presence is pretty astounding. Kudos for all that you are able to do in terms of keeping your face and in your name out there. It's the team.
I cannot take credit for it. Otherwise, it would be a full-time job being online.
Of course. Well, one thing that I came across was your Basics of Sales course. Mm. And here's what I'm curious to know, because people can certainly go take a look at that and see if that's something they're interested in. I'm just curious to hear, in your experience, is it possible to take someone who is not only a creative, so this is someone that might have a rather fragile ego because their work is an expression of their soul and all that goes with that. Mm. Is it possible to teach them these basics of sales and to even get them to a place where they understand and are comfortable entering into a high ticket sales conversation?
Not only is it possible, it's some often preferable. And ego impedes the sale more than often. And in fact, I'd like to think that to a degree, I'm an example of that. I'm not the classic template for a inverted commas sales guy. I was meant to be an academic, and there was a sliding doors moment in 2001, I think it was, when I didn't get funding for my PhD. I was doing a master's degree in history at Warwick University, and my goal was to PhD academic, sit, you know, wearing some old jumper with holes in it, and write books all my life, and just be lost in the romance of learning. And I was very romantic about that kind of thing, and always been quite the introvert, quite nerdy, quite shy, just classically not what you'd expect in a salesperson. And I think without question, the bigger the ticket sales, the less of the wide boy you need, and the more of the elegance is required. And I was speaking to a CEO of a company today in London about this, about how we were talking about his hiring program. One of the things that really matters is having a level of certain level of wit about someone, and someone who gets the depth of the product and what they're trying to do. And if I look at some of the best people who've sold on my teams, they've been the ones who are evangelists first for the story, and they get the greater good, and they are wholly sold on the value. And then I teach them how to deliver that in such a way that it doesn't get boring or over chatty, and it ends up taking someone on a journey that ends with them asking the salesperson to buy the product, or almost, as opposed to, you know, the far other extreme being putting some kind of leash on a pit bull. It's far better, in my opinion, to have someone who has less ego, because they are more likely to be able to listen and deploy empathy to understand that kind of state that the person on the other side of the table is in. And that is where the best salespeople are in. That's kind of the space they inhabit, in my experience.
Well, that makes me curious, because maybe what I heard in there when you said first be an evangelist for the story, which I love, my sense is that what you are describing is that the opportunity to enter into a really wonderful sales conversation that might be a high ticket sales conversation, that there's a lot of why in the start of the story, less about what or who or how, but you're starting with like a why. It's almost a Simon Sinek
Yes.
start with why idea. Is that a bit of what I'm hearing?
It is to a degree, but it also is important to kind of draw out the focus on the wins, in inverted commas, for the prospect. You know, so what are the actual outcomes for that person? And that married with the why is actually what people want to hear. They love the story because it gives it context, but they want the why because it gives the magic of here's what you're going to get. People don't care how things work. What they care about is what do I get? And if that's married with a great story, then the guy buying the Ferrari doesn't care what it looks like or what that device actually is. They care about, am I going to feel successful? Am I going to get more sex? And am I going to look good? Therefore, have £100,000, please. And they're sold on that outcome. How it works, most people don't care about. And I think focusing on the wins for the prospect combined with a wonderful story is really where people need to be focusing their effort.
Well, you're reminding me now, have you heard this famous quote from the poet Maya Angelou, where she said famously, people will forget what you said and people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel.
Precisely. That's exactly it.
Yeah. And it's in that conversation that the buyer, I believe, I'm curious, you're the expert here, so you tell me, but I can't help but think that if I'm a buyer, I want somebody who gets it, meaning I want somebody who can relate with the challenge that I'm up against, what I'm trying to accomplish in the world, where I'm trying to get my career, what my wife and kids are worried about, and am I going to keep my job? Am I going to ever accomplish what I wanted to accomplish with this job? I mean, it's these kinds of things. And if somebody can come in and tell me that their why and my why are aligned, and they're on my team, they're on my side, and I can trust them, then I don't really care, like you said, about the spark plugs or how the battery is connected. Like, just tell me your vehicle is going to get me down the road where I want to go and make me feel like I can trust you. And if and this is going to be fun and we're going to go do something amazing together.
Yeah. And, you know, this is the upside of selling the human animal, is that you are leveraging the fact we're social and we're tribal and we want people who vibe with us. And as a result, the science shows that it's 10% of the reason why people buy, that's the product. It's 30% of the reason people buy is like the process and method, but it's 60%-ish of the reason why people buy is the connection and that feeling of, this is a person who's like me, who has the same values, who gets me. And in the sea of people who may be trying to screw me, because I'm, you know, I've got to be skeptical and cynical about things. Wow, this guy seems to just, we hit it off. And, you know, it's no different to the to looking for cues from the offline world in the social space. You and I and most people listening will have friends that may have known for 10, 15, 20 years. They will also have people they've known for a week. And it seems weird, because you'd think that time and an exposure are the ingredients to a really tight connection. But in fact, it's not that. It's, are you on the same wavelength? And I have people I've known for, you know, 25 years who, if they wanted to go out for a drink, I'd be like, oh, I need to find an excuse. And then there's people I've met, you know, briefly, and it's like, let's hang out, you know. And a perfect example, Tim, who's you know, who was there in Milan, your partner, you know, we hung out tonight and we had to cut it short because we knew he'd be going on all night otherwise. And there's someone I would happily go have a beer with. Yeah, luckily you weren't there. I mean, it wouldn't have been as fun, but still, you know, I'm joking. But you never know what you're going to get until you realize that you're actually on the same wavelength as someone.
So let me ask this, because I know we're about 40 or so minutes into this conversation. Mm. And I think, like you and Tim, I could talk to you all night, but I know it's late there. It must be, what, is it almost midnight there in London?
It's 20 to midnight, and this is my peak hours because I do a lot of US stuff. So
well, let me do this. Before I let you go, I have one quirky little question about a specific area of expertise.
Okay.
And it's about LinkedIn. And here's my question. What is it about LinkedIn, and why is it so special? Because I'm going to add this context to the people that are running creative firms out there. I think most of them view LinkedIn as a platform for business, and therefore they don't think of it as a place where they can express their creativity and talk about design and feelings and art and so forth.
Got it.
Why am I wrong? Why should the guy or gal who runs a creative firm, why should they be paying attention or active on LinkedIn?
It's such an important question, and it is so topical. And yes, LinkedIn is a business platform because it's full of people with the job titles that they have in their companies. But before people are their job title, they are people with the same urges and emotions and views and needs as you and I or anyone else. And so that creative who has a wonderful piece of art that, you know, might spark some conversation with a senior partner at a law firm isn't actually speaking first and foremost to a senior partner at a law firm. They're speaking to a human being. And it's the emotional subconscious part of that brain that's going, do you know what? I love this guy. This feels good. This feels exciting. I love what they've done there or how they've expressed themselves. that is happening because it is a human animal engaging with that content before anything else. And the truth is that LinkedIn, this is something that will never happen again. It's not just a place where it's a wonderful interface or platform where you can put content up. It's not even a place where it's 600 million people who've been there for a long time. It is the combination of a huge volume of people who could buy or at least would consume and maybe distribute your product, who are listening and viewing nothing, relatively speaking, right now. And just to make life really simple to explain that, on Facebook, the thing you do is you post content, so it's noise. On LinkedIn, the thing you don't do is post content, so it's silent. But everyone's there, and half of all users are on it every month, and half of them use it every day. And so to my friend Alina in Italy, who puts oil paintings up, no one does that. And there will always be some people who say, oh, well, this is, you know, you shouldn't do this. This is LinkedIn. This is business. But in the main, there's a lot of people who are like, wow, great, great oil painting. That's really awesome. And so the opportunity is immense for people to leverage the fact it is relatively silent, but they've got the audience and you can put whatever you want in front of them, because since everyone's there, there will be a group of people that are into whatever thing you do. And that might be the latest AR that you've put together that you can showcase in a video. Or it might be I know people who do dancing. I know people who do singing, and they are the person for that thing. And it's, you've got to see it as a content play, and you're speaking to everyone. But the beauty of it is that it doesn't stop at social. If it needs to then map to a business outcome, it can, because that's the context of the platform. So hopefully I've articulated that well enough.
Well, yeah, I think you have. It's interesting, because part of what I heard you say there was, think about how you speak from one human animal to another. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's within the context of business, and perhaps it's all towards a business outcome, but ultimately you're a person speaking to a person.
Yeah, exactly. And before that, I'd say before that person is their job title, that the similar person to you, and we've just talked about this, someone who might really get on with you, and they're like a glass of wine at a pub, like the next person. And remember as well that whilst people use LinkedIn for business, they also use content for a break. And so if you put out an interesting bit of content that stimulates conversation rather than tries to sell people, which is why corporates in the main, the ones I work with, when I go to them but with their LinkedIn strategy, they're failing miserably, because they're like, hey, look at us, come and buy my thing. And no one's interested in that. Whereas if you actually take a step back and entertain or give value with no outward agenda, or, you know, just generally be the host of a conversation about maybe the subculture of what you do, or to stimulate some form of discussion or interaction, suddenly people start wanting to spend time around you, and that converts to some really spectacular opportunities, because you become the hub for these interesting, you know, pieces of content. Maybe it's discussion, maybe it's art, whatever it might be. And there's enough people on there. There isn't elsewhere, but there are enough people on there that there will be plenty of little tribes of people who really dig whatever it is that you may do.
Well, let's wrap it up with one more reminder of the event. One that's happening this Thursday night in Atlanta, but also this is an event series that you do. If someone wants to find out more about that event series, where should we point them?
Yeah, probably the best place for now, if you go to therichardmoore.com, there's the tab that is Entrepreneur Business Live, and you can see all the events that are currently being rolled out. So we've got Atlanta this week, London the next week, and then plenty more coming through, Miami in April and some other lovely locations as well. So I'm really excited about it. And what's really nice is that we've created a really simple model where if people want to host their own Entrepreneur Business Live, they can go do it, and I'll happily help them out with it. And You know, it's nice now. I'm hoping that there are something like 30 or 40 events at least this year. Hopefully not all of them I'm traveling to go to, and but that people can run on their own and do good things with. So therichardmoore.com, you can find out much more information there. Or we have a page, just search Entrepreneur Business Live on LinkedIn.
Oh, that's very cool. Okay, so therichardmoore.com.
Yeah.
And I'm like you. I wish I could go to every event, but obviously time and money and space being limited as they are. But nonetheless, I hope to see you either in London or New York, LA, wherever soon. And of course, I'm excited to join you Thursday for the event in Atlanta.
I'll be watching on the live stream. In fact, I'll be in LA in September, so we'll definitely hook up then. That'd be really cool.
Great.
Yeah, I'll be watching the live stream, so you make sure you wave.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your perspective and your journey. I appreciate all the transitions that you've been through. So just from one human animal, as you say, to another. Thanks for being on the podcast.
You're welcome. Really enjoyed it, Joel. Thanks. Really stimulating stuff.
You've been listening to the Rev Thinking Podcast. For more information on upcoming accelerators, events, or to learn how RevThink advises creative entrepreneurs like you, connect with us at revthink.com.
I want to tell you about a place to connect that you might not know about. It's our online community called Rev Community. It's a great place to get to know other creative business owners like yourself, to share some thought leadership and read other encouragement, to be challenged in this new marketplace, new technology, ideas, economic trends. And it's a place to research. Check out many of the resources we have online, our videos, and of course, this podcast. Join us today at revthink.com/community. If you're a creative studio owner, feel free to join us today at revthink.com/community. I look forward to seeing you there.